Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, dragging you back into the madness and mayhem of the true crime underworld once again. On today's menu is another fascinating journey inside the psychology of what has become one of the more perplexing crimes of the last 20 years, the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey. But before we begin, I have a quick announcement to make. As many of you have noticed, VIP subscribers on the website are now receiving 4 episodes per month, rather than 3 plus blog posts. I will no longer be writing the blog posts, instead substituting an extra episode. The Richard Speck episode was the first of those. Beyond that, if you are currently subscribed to a certain tier, you can remain there moving forward as long as you don't cancel. But with the start of next month's schedule, all new subscribers will have only one option, which is to purchase access to all 4 episodes on a monthly basis. On top of that, I have some other exciting news, which is that I'll be starting another podcast soon that analyzes all of your favorite horror films. Much more information on that to follow in the coming weeks, so stay tuned. But enough of the business, let's do this. On the morning of January 24th, 2006, a young Orlando, Florida woman named Jennifer Kesey fails to show up at work for an important meeting, drawing concern from her employers, family, friends, and boyfriend. Unable to reach her by phone on her cell or on the landline in her nearby condo, the parties ultimately get in contact with one another and learn nobody can establish her whereabouts at the time. Her family quickly decides this is out of character and makes plans to travel to Jennifer's new condo, which is located in the Mosaic at Millenia, a development that's under construction and only sparsely populated with new residents. While the police are called, it's also quickly ascertained that the last person to speak with Jennifer was her boyfriend, Rob, with whom she was having a long-distance relationship. That took place on Jennifer's landline at her condo the night before and concluded at approximately 10 p.m. That's when the mystery starts. Now, to set this up, Rob and Jennifer were involved in a long-distance relationship at the time, as I mentioned, albeit one where they both still lived in the state of Florida, Jennifer in Orlando, and Rob in Fort Lauderdale. So, this was a situation where they were commuting to see each other on the weekends, and the prevailing notion seems to be that Jennifer was hoping the relationship might move forward with the two of them living together and negating the extensive travel that was seemingly taking a toll on her. So the weekend prior to Jennifer's disappearance, she and Rob go on a trip together, and Jennifer reports to her family and coworkers that it was a great time. Upon their arrival back in town, Jennifer drives directly to work from Rob's place on the morning of Monday, January 23rd. That evening, around 6 p.m., she leaves work in the presence of a coworker, who then becomes the last person to see Jennifer before she meets her fate. She does, however, have contact with family and friends later that night by way of phone, the last occurrence being the call with Rob. In summary, Jennifer's whereabouts can't be accounted for by another person after 10 p.m. on the night of January 23rd, 2006. Now, circling back to our discussion of the following day, January 24th, Jennifer's family arrives at her apartment in search of her. While the cops will initially assign the situation as a likely fight with her boyfriend from which she would return in just a few hours, it quickly became evident that wasn't the case, and soon enough the police were involved as well. Here's what they find inside Jennifer's condo. Nobody is there, of course, and there's no sign of forced entry of any kind. A few outfits are laid out on the bed side by side, as though somebody might have been deciding what to wear. Beneath them, the bed is neatly made, and Jennifer's new favorite shoes, alligator pumps, are missing from the closet. Her cell phone, briefcase, and purse are missing, but only in the sense that it appears she simply got dressed for work and left. The taupe shoes match the outfits laid out on the bed, so it seems like a reasonable conclusion. Obviously, Jennifer's car is gone from the parking lot outside as well, supporting the notion she simply got ready for work and left. And remember that the bed is neatly made, because I'm going to show you that I don't believe she ever slept in it the night before. Moving along, There's also no sign of a struggle inside the apartment. Nothing spilled, nothing tipped over or broken. And that's when they look inside the bathroom. But there was only more of the same evidence supporting Jennifer going to work. A damp towel, wet walls inside the shower, a blow dryer out on the counter. For all intents and purposes, what was discovered in Jennifer's wake wasn't suspicious. Yet. Because this is when we learn her cell phone stopped pinging the night before around 10:40 p.m. Not only that, but Jennifer also had possession of a second cell phone at her condo that was left by a guest over the weekend when she was in St. Croix. Apparently, she allowed her younger brother and some friends to use the place to party under the condition it would be returned to its original state at the conclusion of the weekend. For all intents and purposes, that seems to have happened, but one of the guys forgot his cell phone in the process. Jennifer learned of this through her brother before she got home from vacation and agreed to ship the phone back to its owner. So, that phone was also missing from her apartment, and it too stopped pinging around 10:40 p.m. that night, the same time as Jennifer's phone. The police claim the batteries were removed from the phones, and while that can't be proven, it does seem to be the most likely scenario, even if it is possible, in some cases, for a phone in 2006 to be turned off and lose connection to a tower, thereby not pinging and revealing location as it would when it's on. So, did Jennifer have a reason to turn off both phones and remove the batteries? We don't know. But we do know she goes missing shortly thereafter, and an abductor would have a very strong motive for not wanting to have his movements tracked. And that's the first rabbit hole in this case. Everybody wants to know the truth about what happened with the phones, specifically because an official timeline for Jennifer's disappearance has to be established. The major lingering question to this day, beyond where Jennifer ended up, is when she really left. Was Jennifer Kessie attacked either inside or outside her apartment on the night of January 23rd, as the phones might suggest? Or did she meet her abductor on the morning of January 24th, either on the way to her car or at some point on the drive to work? The general consensus renders a notion that this missing information is critical to solving the case. But I'm calling bullshit on that. I don't think it matters. We're going to examine a number of factors that many believe are crucial, yet they're nonsense. The time of her disappearance will establish a person's guilt only once that person becomes a suspect with corroborating evidence to suggest the party is guilty. Because this is the truth. If I had magic powers right now and could tell you definitively whether or not Jennifer disappeared on the morning of January 24th or on the evening of January 23rd, we would not be one inch closer to finding her body. That revelation would offer nothing. And the rest of the case is plagued by similar. It's more than 12 years later, and this case has spawned more new false leads than a tabloid, all of them fully awash in suspicion and dreadfully absent of fact. It's truly sad, because this is a human being who clearly met an untimely death at the hands of a predator, likely an attack that was sexually inspired and culminated in murder as a means of concealing the evidence. But there's no apparent narrative when you follow the evidence. There's no path that leads to a solution. So the road I want to take you down is the creation of a psychological narrative of the events, a recreation of what might have happened based upon what we do know. If we look at the evidence available, what is the thought process that would lead to such a situation? The missing evidence in this case resides in movement, but we can't access a view of the physical movements of those involved. So we'll have to do so intellectually by examining the desires embedded in the journey. The reason is this. The abductor, or abductors plural, if that's the case, have an emotional goal that correlates to the physical one in the sense that they want to commit the crime and dispose of the body, yet accomplish that goal within a framework of also offering themselves the emotional comfort of safety from getting caught. Basically, they want her to disappear, along with any notion they might have been involved in the crime in the first place. So rather than taking stock in what transpires on the surface, we're going to examine the negative space, the shade, the darkness, the subtext. At its core, I believe this is a fairly simple case, one rife with as much motive for it to not be investigated further as it is with demands for the mystery to finally be solved. When I review the case in its totality, however, what I see is a clear picture of police refusal that's based in the lack of probability the suspect can be identified and apprehended utilizing available resources. There's a popular sentiment, whether true or false, that the two detectives initially assigned to the case not only retired on the same day 9 months later, but also never took a single note. If that's true, or even if it's just a representation of the poor effort expended by law enforcement in the early days of the investigation, it's worth noting beyond the consideration that they might have been lazy. There are many times when police are described as lazy in a situation where the proper terminology is unwilling. And I believe that's what we have here. If I ask myself, in all honesty, after reviewing the facts of this case, if I, hypothetically, as a police officer, would stop at nothing to arrest the suspect in this disappearance? The answer is no. I believe this case has been investigated seriously in recent years. I also believe it's too late to make a difference. 12 years of silence supports that notion. In the beginning, however, in my humble opinion, they just weren't interested. And I believe it's because, when you strip away all the hype and glitter, a very obvious, sad, and simple story is staring right back at you. But more importantly, that story was written with a faceless monster fading to anonymity at the end. Or was he faceless? Because Jennifer's car turns up mere hours after her disappearance, abandoned by a suspect who seemingly has not a single care in the world that he could potentially be caught on video, when in fact, he is. So let's take a look at that, and then circle back to Jennifer's apartment to give the evidence there a much closer look, specifically in the context of the new information. From there, we'll move on to theories about what might have happened, in addition to exploring the many suspects who have come, gone, and perpetually lingered. At approximately noon on January 24th, 2006, the day of Jennifer's disappearance, security footage captured at the Huntington-on-the-Green apartment complex, which is 1.2 miles from Jennifer's condo, offers several vantage points of a person abandoning her car in a visitor's spot and walking out of the complex, never to be seen again. What's worse is that, while the footage is grainy to an extent it's not useful for definitively identifying the person, there's no sign of Jennifer with him. To this day, there has been no confirmed sighting of Jennifer after 6 p.m. on January 23rd, when she left the company of a coworker as they exited the building for the evening. With that in mind, I want to quickly address the likelihood of what transpired. All signs point to Jennifer being murdered and subsequently disposed of in an unknown location, at which point this person returns the car to a location near her condo. Obviously, it can't be left near the body, as concealing the body is clearly the priority in this case. One would have to speculate DNA evidence would be the reason. In that light, the motive is most likely sexual, yet not tied to any type of sex trafficking, instead being a crime of opportunity in which the perpetrator primarily intended to rape and ultimately killed by necessity of not getting caught for his actions by leaving her as a witness. Jennifer simply does not fit the profile of somebody who would be drawn into sex trafficking. While stories of kidnappings run amok, a greater truth is that people who work in the sex trade are often lured rather than taken unwillingly. Easy targets are girls and young women who are recently homeless or even hopeless and are more likely to fall into the throes of addiction and compliance with abuse in exchange for drugs, a place to stay, and a way to survive. The needy, broken, abused, lost, runaways. These are the types of victims the predators seek. Jennifer Kessie, on the other hand, not a drug addict, had a good job, was a homeowner at age 24, and enjoyed a boyfriend, loving parents, and vacations, among other things. You couldn't pick a woman less likely to comply with the notion of becoming a drug-addicted prostitute. Basically, you're asking for a problem. It's a fight. Somebody like this doesn't wilt psychologically. As an independent adult woman, she would be the most problematic victim you could choose. Think of it this way. If you're Charles Manson, you can convince Susan Atkins to kill people, but you can't convince Jennifer Kessie to do the same. And it's because she has a life. You're taking from her, not giving. That perception can't be altered very easily. So whereas sex traffickers more often try to lead their victims into the lifestyle like horses to water, Jennifer would be akin to forcing it to drink after dragging it there. In addition, people like Jennifer often garner the attention of national media when they disappear. And while murder allows the guilty party to dispose of the body, sex trafficking actually forces the perpetrators to collect the victims of the crimes. With that in mind, all it takes is one tourist in Mexico to notice her working at a brothel, and the entire operation is compromised. So in my estimation, she doesn't fit the profile, and I don't believe Jennifer Kessie was kidnapped for the purposes of human trafficking of any kind. Of course, there are stories from multiple eyewitnesses that suggest this might be a possibility, but to this day, none has been confirmed as genuine. Nor will they be. But getting back to this person abandoning Jennifer's car at the Huntington-on-the-Green Apartments, what we learn from the footage is that the driver pulls into a spot, backs out, and then pulls in again as though he took the action to straighten his park job within the space. He then waits 32 seconds before exiting the vehicle, which could have been spent wiping something down, looking for police, or both. Yet, what he doesn't seem to be concerned with is being caught on any cameras or being identified by anybody present in the apartment complex. It's my understanding that this is the type of place where one could always expect some people to be hanging around outside or going about their business as usual. It seems to be common knowledge that there's a lot of activity at the apartments. Whereas Jennifer's condo is in a more upscale development nearby, the Huntington-on-the-Green is known for being in an area that's considered sketchy, by most standards, meaning that drug dealing and other such activities allegedly took place there. Nonetheless, there are going to be people home during the day, even on a Tuesday, and there are countless windows in this complex facing not only the spot where the car is abandoned, but also the areas the driver walked through to exit onto the street. Again, there's no apparent regard for witnesses or security cameras. The focus of the person abandoning the car is to evade police. We could make the assumption that he's just not very bright, but I think that's a mistake. The rest of the crime is quite mysterious, to say the least. If we take even just a cursory look at the psychology of the perpetrator of this act, what he's telling us is that the only thing that matters is that he evades police at the time. Just think about his next actions after getting out of the car. He walks out of the parking lot, past the pool, and then out of the complex toward the street, where we get a closer look at some of the characteristics of the suspect as he passes a gate. Unfortunately, the irony is that another gate, specifically his own, in the form of the way he walks, causes him to stride past in view of the camera, but have his face blocked by two gateposts as he transitions from one stride to the next. But again, he makes no effort to conceal his identity. He just leaves the complex. So what we can see is that the person appears to be dressed in all white, yet sporting dark-colored shoes that are just a bit odd in a few ways. While the white shirt and pants appear to be perhaps a painter's uniform or something similar, the shoes almost seem a bit too large for the person and not fit for hard work. They look more like a dress shoe than a boot worn at a construction site. Of course, law enforcement later deduces through the proportions in the video, as well as a recreation, that the perpetrator was between 5 feet 3 inches tall and 5 feet 5 inches tall. And while some have questioned the gender of this person, to my eyes he's clearly male. What I see on top of his head is dark hair pulled back into a tight bun at the rear, which is a popular style when working in the trades because your hair can get caught in anything from wet paint to a moving elevator shaft. Now, the police have suggested that the perpetrator could in fact be wearing darker clothes than what appears in the video, as they learned people in their own group appeared on the footage of these cameras in darker clothes that showed up light. But given the contrast of the dark shoes the perpetrator is wearing to the pants and shirt that appear to be white, and the dark hair on top of his head, it's likely we're seeing a decent representation of the truth. If the shoes weren't lightened by the cameras, they must have been pretty dark. If his hair wasn't lightened by the cameras, it must have been pretty dark. Knowing that, by default, the shirt and pants have to be much lighter in order to appear that way in the footage. And this brings up the question of race. For me, based upon experience, this is simple. Others feel differently. At a surface level, the man appears to be white or Hispanic. I live in a county where 47% of the residents are Hispanic, and previously lived in a different place within that county where approximately 75% of the residents are Hispanic. And what I clearly see in that footage is a Hispanic male. I could be wrong, of course, but another aspect of probability that occurs to me is that I've met quite a few Hispanic men who stand between 5 feet 3 inches tall and 5 feet 5 inches tall. But when I place that in terms of the context of white men, that number is no more than 3, or maybe 5. Now, statistics show the average height of an adult American male is 5 feet 9 inches tall, while the average height of a Mexican male is 5 feet 7 and a half inches tall. What that tells us is something that's been true to my experience in the real world. A Mexican man who has been living his whole life in Mexico and then emigrates to the United States is likely to be shorter in stature than American men of Mexican descent whose families have been living in the country for generations. That's been my experience where I live. Most, but not all, of the men I run into who fit the 5 feet 3 inches to 5 feet 5 inches height spectrum are Hispanic men who have come from another country more recently and still speak Spanish as their primary language. Again, this is all speculation, but what I see is a young Hispanic man dressed like he's about to return to work in a trade such as painting, drywall, or similar. These clothes don't appear to have casual functionality. I wouldn't wear them elsewhere, so I'm guessing he wouldn't either. So, if you were an undocumented worker at a nearby construction site and had just dumped a body after committing murder and also needed to abandon the car, where would you do it? The answer is near the construction site because you have to walk back to work and can't be gone all day. So the 1.2 miles between Jennifer's condo and the Huntington on the Green is simply an indication of how close the driver was willing to get to the crime scene in the car, given the circumstance that he had to return there and do so in a reasonable amount of time. He can't dump her in the middle of nowhere and walk back, so he gets as close to his destination as possible before abandoning the vehicle. It's noon, lunchtime. The workers were probably on lunch at the time, or with an early start time set to return. Which means this would have to be, at least to a certain extent, a conspiracy. So, let's take a look at that as we return to Jennifer's apartment and examine more of the evidence and how those pieces might fit into the puzzle I'm describing here. Because in the end, one thing about this case is undeniably true. None of the suspects being scrutinized in the public eye as potentially being Jennifer's killer is the man we see abandoning her car in the video. From her current boyfriend to her jealous co-workers, and beyond that to her ex-boyfriend struggling to get over her, the one common thread among all of these possibilities is that they would have to involve a conspiracy. Yet, in line with my thinking, there is absolutely no identifiable connection between the man in the video and any of those people. So what we get in this case is public willingness to label certain individuals as guilty, yet in the absence of making any correlation to the man dumping the car. Of course, we have to believe the police have access to more footage than the public. They might have an even better idea of the suspect's identity, especially given the fact they know when he was driving the car and could check nearby businesses for security videos of roadways he used. We can only speculate. Okay, so let's get back to Jennifer's apartment now and try to place some of the evidence in the context of the car being dumped 1.2 miles away at the Huntington on the Green apartments. We know for sure that event happened. Let's figure out why. Inside Jennifer Kesey's home, we have evidence that two cell phones are missing, one being Jennifer's and the other belonging to her brother's friend. At approximately 10:40 p.m. the night of January 23rd, both phones stopped pinging a tower, presumably because the batteries were removed, according to police. This seems to indicate something went wrong about that time. The likelihood that Jennifer would find reason to remove the batteries is slim. Yet, here we have Jennifer's apartment looking as though she had just gotten ready for work the morning of the 24th and left, as I discussed previously. All of the missing items from her apartment are things she would have taken to work. So, the phone issues indicate a strong possibility of foul play the evening before, while Jennifer getting ready for work the next morning suggests nothing happened until she left. And that's been the central focus of the argument about how this incident transpired in terms of the logistics. When did she disappear? The night before or the next morning? So people are staring at the evidence and trying to choose which side they're on, morning or night, as though it matters. But it doesn't. At least not now. For the moment, we need to ask the right questions, because we're not able to definitively determine when Jennifer was abducted. So for me, the right line of questioning begins with this. Why did the phones need to leave the apartment in the first place? If you're the abductor and you remove the batteries from the phone the night before, why have you taken that action? You could just as easily turn the phones off or lower the ringer volume and leave them just as they are. In that case, they never leave the home and give no clue as to Jennifer's whereabouts. And this is where that notion becomes very revealing. If Jennifer was abducted the morning of January 24th after leaving her home, it means the phones were with her. But that doesn't fit the narrative of the batteries being removed the night before. The phones, or at least Jennifer's, as you would think she'd put her own battery back in the morning in order to call her boyfriend, would ping the tower up until her disappearance in that case. but it doesn't. What becomes obvious in the tug of war between the event happening at night or in the morning is that the narrative suggests it was both. This crime started at night, just prior to the batteries being removed, continued into the morning at Jennifer's apartment, and culminated with the strange man abandoning the car. No matter what you believe, however, one thing is clear. Jennifer leaving for work in the morning, or at least appearing to have done so, is the desired result of the perpetrator. So, if you're her ex-boyfriend, or jealous co-workers, or anybody else for that matter, why would you need to make the situation appear as though Jennifer went to work? With no sign of a struggle, or even DNA evidence at the apartment, it's pretty clear nobody was trying to cover up a bloodbath inside. So what we really need to identify is the reason for this misdirection. And the truth is staring us in the face. The only reason to make everybody believe Jennifer disappeared by driving away from her apartment that morning is that you, the killer, were still going to be there. Or at least, would be returning to the location. And here we have a man who appears to be a construction worker of some kind, only hours after Jennifer would have left for work, dumping her car near her home before walking somewhere on foot. Guess where he's going? Right back to the construction site. Because if he lives elsewhere and works elsewhere, he can just leave the car right there in the parking lot at the condo. Nothing is gained by parking it 1.2 miles down the street, and it's an enormous risk to leave your DNA inside. Now, they only find one strand of DNA, but who knows if that's valuable. The car was obviously wiped down. But if you need the crime to appear as though it took place outside of the construction site, what you're trying to prove is that she left voluntarily. So what we see is that, above all else, even discretion, the suspect values the appearance of Jennifer having left the construction site before being accosted. He's on camera, he leaves DNA in her car, and makes no attempt to disguise himself, but in terms of how and when Jennifer left the Mosaic at the Millennia, we're 100% baffled. The genesis of the crime is being protected at all costs. The culmination is literally public knowledge. If you were an undocumented worker at the construction site who planned to be gone days from then, perhaps even going back to a foreign country, your goal would be to only buy the time you needed to make your exit and not to perpetually evade authorities until your last breath on this earth. In that light, you'd take actions designed to delay suspicion rather than alleviate it. So, we know that some of these workers at the site were catcalling Jennifer, and she explicitly expressed to family that it made her quite uncomfortable. She seemed to be a bit unnerved by the fact that the development was still so empty in terms of units that were actually occupied at that point. And some of these workers, even the undocumented ones, were staying in unoccupied condos. So, these people weren't necessarily traceable, given that they had no citizenship or legal right to work in the country, in addition to homes without addresses. It tends to be a common theme. Some illegal immigrants come and go, never establishing an address before heading back to their homeland due to lack of opportunity, separation from family, deportation, or eluding fallout from criminal acts. I don't see this case any differently than that. I think our phantom is gone. But let's circle back to the list of suspects. The first is Jennifer's ex-boyfriend, Nat, who seems to be having some trouble getting over their relationship, something he expressed to her in conversation. Now, that doesn't necessarily make him a killer. In fact, far from it. But here's where it gets interesting. This ex, who doesn't live anywhere near Jennifer, was drinking at the Blue Martini at a mall right down the road from her the night before she disappeared. Staff described him as very drunk and the young man apparently didn't show up for work the next morning. While this sounds suspicious, consider what it would have taken for a very drunk man to last through the night in a conspiracy with another man to abduct Jennifer, murder her, and dispose of the body and vehicle the next morning. That's an unfathomable marathon for somebody in that condition, and there simply isn't any physical evidence to tie him to the crime. So we move along. Next up, we take a look inside Jennifer's workplace, where catcalling construction workers are replaced by her own co-workers harassing her for dates and similar. In fact, the two primary players in this game are two of Jennifer's male co-workers, one of whom is married with children, and the other being someone who was managed by that person. But what becomes even more evident, above all else, is that a lot of people in Jennifer's world were upset and frustrated they couldn't have sex with her, whether it was a coworker, construction guy, or ex-boyfriend. From top to bottom, that's what we learn. People wanted Jennifer and couldn't have her. Ultimately, one of them decided to take matters into his own hands. And the psychology of the situation says it was the person who had the most to lose if the police believed Jennifer never left for work in the morning. In that light, let's imagine that Jennifer's car never left the parking lot at her condo that day. What if the police show up at the condo and Jennifer is gone under the same circumstances, but her car is there instead of missing? See what I'm getting at? It says that she never left. And if there's no evidence she was attacked in her apartment, guess where the cops are going to start looking? Elsewhere at the construction site, including knocking on the doors of workers who live there while the place is being built. But that doesn't happen right away. Predictably, the abductor gets what he wants in this scenario with the missing car, as everybody swarms to Jennifer's condo and looks outward from there, trying to track the vehicle. They're all turned from the truth, following a trajectory away from the assailant. Misdirection always reveals truth because, by nature, it's born of a lie. And the lie here is that Jennifer left for work in the morning. The misdirection is the location of the car. Therefore, the thing from which attention is being diverted is the place where the car would otherwise be parked. And that's at the construction site. People are desperately looking for Jennifer and her car at the time, neither of which are at the construction site. So if you're the killer, where's the best place to be? Right fucking there at the Mosaic at Millennia, where you just walked after ditching her car and went back to work, in the absence of Jennifer or her car. Accordingly, which people end up being persons of interest in this case, far and above the notion of a construction worker pulling off the abduction? Everybody outside the construction site. The jealous co-workers, the suffering ex-boyfriend, and even the possibility of sex traffickers kidnapping Jennifer into their trade. But nobody can even begin to connect the dots between these people and the man who appears in the security footage from the Huntington on the Green dumping Jennifer's car. There's this strange sensibility that the person responsible is not the man driving Jennifer's car that day, and we'll only know who he is once we figure out which of the known suspects killed her with his help. And I'm over here like, hello? Wake up. He's the fucking guy. This man is on video driving the car of a woman who hasn't been seen alive in 12 years since that day. Am I missing something? He's taking a huge risk. He's the guy. The man on the video is taking an astronomical risk in comparison to anyone else who might have conspired with him in the crime. He's driving the car of a person who's been reported missing, someone who never returns, and doing it within little more than a mile from her home. It sounds like the type of thing you wouldn't do unless the responsibility was yours due to your actions. Of course, you might do something like this if you were paid well enough. But again, there's just no evidence that suggests any of the known suspects hired somebody to kill Jennifer and dispose of her. There is, however, evidence that the man in the video is involved in the crime. He abandons a car and never returns. There's no misunderstanding in his intentions. Many people would like to suggest he might be someone who was randomly offered a few bucks to dump the car somewhere. I won't even entertain that. Not because it isn't plausible, but because it's an effort to make somebody other than the guy who gets caught on camera abandoning the car responsible for the crime. It's a desperate need to vicariously attach guilt to other suspects to satisfy a narrative that isn't supported by the facts and is heavily predicated on suspicion. This is not somebody transporting drugs or carrying out a hit on a political figure who knows too much. This case has all the markings of abduction related primarily to sexual assault and ultimately murder. Jennifer doesn't come home. If somebody simply wanted her dead and had hired help, she could have been executed with a single gunshot at any number of locations, including her own condo development. Nothing like that happened. She was taken or led from the point of abduction, not killed there in a struggle, and subsequently disposed, which means there were reasons for that. Rape and murder are the most likely. In any murder, the body tells a very specific story about the intentions of the perpetrator. If Jennifer was raped, and especially if she was raped by more than one person, it would be of the utmost importance to hide the body as well as possible, or preferably destroy it in some way, to avoid allowing it to tell that tale. And if you were involved in this conspiracy, specifically as the person in charge of getting rid of the car, it probably wouldn't seem very suspicious to your coworkers if you dropped it off 1.2 miles down the road, walked back, and rejoined them as they finished lunch and began the second half of the workday. So the idea I'm getting at here, as we move into the known suspects in Jennifer's life, is that this doesn't, in any way, seem to be a crime of passion. In terms of spontaneity, nobody flies off the handle. While it's motivated by sex, it's cold, calculated, and seemingly very much planned by somebody who knew Jennifer's routine. Yet there's no forced entry, which indicates a crime of opportunity. In order to commit a crime of opportunity, you need to be in the right place at the right time. And the easiest way to do that is to always be there. So if you live at the location of the crime and also work there, you have incredible advantages. You don't have to kick in Jennifer's door. You don't have to pry open a window or even get her in broad daylight as she walks to her car. None of that is necessary. In fact, you have to act with so little desperation, you won't even be seen watching. But everybody else, the guys who explicitly say they want Jennifer, they're all suspects. My question is this: why? Why is it more likely that suspects who have been interviewed by police are guilty than those who haven't, when 12 years have passed and the allegedly guilty parties are still around? Their names are public. They have nowhere to hide. Yet not one of these people has ever been arrested for Jennifer's death, despite significant accusations that would suggest involvement. And that's because it's bullshit. So let's dive into her coworkers here and see what we find. Now, apparently Jennifer worked with a guy named Johnny, who was married with kids, but still very much interested in her despite those considerations. On many occasions, he'd made it clear through conversation and email that he wanted to date her, and Jennifer had actually ended up discussing this situation with her father. Supposedly, Jennifer didn't engage in romantic relationships at work and felt like she needed to find the right way to tell him without making the situation worse. Her father goes on to suggest the two meet for lunch in a work setting rather than any kind of date, where she can speak to him more openly about her reasons for turning him down. Apparently, that lunch happened, and Jennifer reported that it went well. If she approached her father about it in the first place, it stands to reason she wouldn't lie about the result. But perhaps this Johnny character isn't so docile after all. A few days before Jennifer leaves for the trip with her boyfriend, Johnny gets pulled over by the police and receives a traffic ticket, which causes him to become upset to the point he tears it up in front of the cop. That action gets him taken to jail for the next 2 days, and he misses work. Upon returning, he learns Jennifer has just left for vacation with her boyfriend, something Johnny apparently didn't know was taking place. So there's a lot of speculation that he might have become jealous by this. When Jennifer returns from vacation, according to another employee, Johnny approaches her at her desk and demands to know where she was. He seems bothered by the fact that she went away with her boyfriend for the weekend, implying there was jealousy at the symbolic nature of the vacation being the next step in the relationship. And to a certain extent, it was intended to spawn the potential for Jennifer and Rob either moving in together or reconsidering their long-distance relationship. Undoubtedly, Johnny wanted her to become single. So when she returned with news that it was a great time, Johnny seemed really mad. That was the morning of January 23rd, the day before Jennifer disappeared. At least, that's what another employee tells us. Somebody Johnny managed. But it's all speculation, right? Just gossip. Well, not so fast. This guy went to Human Resources to file a complaint. Which is interesting. But it happens 5 years later. You heard that correctly. So while most people are focused on the sensationalistic aspect of what's contained within the complaint, and focused on Johnny as being a maniac, I'm asking myself this. What the hell is wrong with the guy who filed the complaint? Let's explore that. First off, the complaint alleges that the employee feared for his safety because he had reason to believe Johnny was involved in the murder of Jennifer Kesey, a notion supported by many suspicious actions and statements allegedly transpiring over the course of the time the two of them spent together on the afternoon of January 24th, 2006, hours after Jennifer disappeared. The complaint suggests that Johnny Campos didn't arrive at work until noon on January 24, 2006, and was distracted and nervous upon finally getting there. Shortly after arriving, he asked the aforementioned employee to drive him to one of their satellite offices, which was a quite unusual request, especially given the fact that there was no explanation for why Johnny wouldn't be taking his Ford Taurus. Along the way, they discussed the situation with Jennifer, given the fact she didn't show up for an important meeting earlier in the day, and her whereabouts were unknown. The employee alleges that Johnny told him she'd probably already been eaten by gators by now, and also claims he told Johnny not to say things like that, but Johnny repeated those words soon after anyway. Upon reaching the other office, Johnny speaks to a few people, and then they return to their office. There doesn't really seem to be a purpose for the trip. Of course, this looks really bad for Johnny. In 2006. But it's 5 years later, and this guy telling the story, in my mind, is absolutely 100% full of shit. If you believed your coworker was a murderer on January 24th, 2006, why did you sit next to him in silence for the next 5 years? Are you kidding me? This is totally transparent. This person is a maniac. Accordingly, the company fires him weeks after making the complaint, because obviously this was terribly misguided, and there's nothing to find here. accept a truth that should have been evident from the start. The person at work who was truly harassing Jennifer was the employee who filed the complaint, not the manager. Word has it that he was the one who was obsessed. And suddenly, after years of trashing the manager's name, the employee is guilty. But this is nonsense. That utilizes the same faulty logic. What should be obvious in this charade is that Jennifer Kessie is a pawn in some kind of dick-measuring chess match between this employee and his manager. While most of the company has moved on after 5 years, these two are still doing battle in the same place. If you believed your manager was a murderer and your life was in jeopardy, you wouldn't wait 5 years to say so. Likewise, if you're the manager and this employee is fabricating stories about you from 5 years ago, it very clearly says that your issues stem from something other than Jennifer. I'm going to be perfectly honest here, and just because that's what I do. When I learned of this mess between these two coworkers, my immediate impression was that they're attracted to each other. That's the truth I saw. I firmly believed that if I found a photo of one or both of them, my impression would be that the person would not appear to me as a strictly heterosexual male. And that was exactly the case. I found a photo of one of these guys and was immediately struck by the inclination to believe my intuition. I could certainly be 100% wrong, but this is my intuition, and it's what I see looking at the photo. Either way, a relationship exists between the two, even if only emotional, that's very tense. There has to be a reason for that. And after 5 years of remaining at each other's sides, while most other people have moved on, it isn't Jennifer Kessie. That's why, 12 years later, neither man has drawn anything more than suspicion from police. The problem arose by way of their relationship, and not her murder. In fact, Johnny goes on to outlast all of his contemporaries at the company in terms of tenure, and it's probably not because his employer thinks he does a great job at hiding a body. In reality, it seems these two were competing for Jennifer's attention at the same time back in 2006, and likely developed a certain distaste for each other that created a rivalry of sorts. Or maybe even a crush. We don't know. But in my estimation, no matter what the truth is behind this disagreement, this is typical office bullshit that got sensationalized in the aftermath of the murder out of convenience. And what makes it even sillier is that, if you can even bring yourself to believe one of these guys is guilty, you still need to tie him to the man who abandoned the car. The reality is that you can't. Neither can I. Nor can the police or FBI. The most reasonable conclusion in this case is that we don't know the identity of the killer. We can assume a coworker killed Jennifer because he couldn't have her, or an ex-boyfriend, but we know they had nothing to do with disposing of her car, which severely negates the likelihood in the form of strong physical evidence. Every suspect in this case is attached at the hip to the guy dropping off the car. It doesn't work. We have to identify the man in the security footage from the Huntington on the Green apartments. And this is where we get to the reason the initial two detectives working the case didn't take any notes. They feared the rabbit hole. Tracking this guy down was going to be extremely difficult. So nobody did. I hate to say it that way, but that's what I very clearly see in this case. An undocumented worker from Jennifer's condo development abducted her for the purpose of rape, murdered her, disposed of the body, and walked back to the place where he works and lives. It's been confirmed that it wasn't unusual for these undocumented workers to come and go, and police admitted having difficulty in properly questioning them for that reason, among many others. The psychology of the narrative, in my opinion, says this happened. So let's take a look at how the crime might have transpired. And yes, already I'm sure people are saying, Ryan, you missed this, you missed that, but to me it's all extraneous. The truth is screaming in my face, and it's hard to look away. I don't care about suspicion and accusations. I care about the narrative constructed by way of the events. So, the first sign of trouble in this case happens at 10:40 p.m. on the night of January 3rd, as mentioned. Given that nobody has heard from Jennifer since that moment, and her cell phones did not ping the towers again in the morning, it's most likely she was abducted at night, sometime after the conclusion of the call with Rob. And this is where things become revealing in the narrative. Jennifer is home at 10 p.m. We know this happened because she used the landline to call Rob. Therefore, if we believe the incident started after that call, yet also before the batteries were removed at 10:40 p.m., and there's also no sign of forced entry, what we can see is that Jennifer was abducted when she left her condo that night. Again, some have speculated that she might have gone out to try to ship her brother's friend's phone back to him, but that doesn't seem like a very reasonable choice. It's a phone some guy left at her apartment because he was hungover. She can ship it the next day at work. In fact, a new DVD player Rob gave Jennifer was also strapped into the back seat of her car by way of a seatbelt. No one's really sure why, except that she might have been planning to return it at the same time she sent the phone. So, it's possible Jennifer was attempting to ship something that night, but not likely, given that it was after 10 p.m. Anything she sent, if there was even a place to go at that time of night, wouldn't depart that location until the next day. The logic doesn't add up. So, it's more likely Jennifer exited the apartment to complete a task such as taking out the garbage or placing the DVD player and her brother's friend's cell phone in the car so she wouldn't forget to do it in the morning. It's reported that Jennifer's brother told her on Monday, January 23rd, that his friend needed the phone sent back because he used it for work, and Jennifer replied that she'd do it the next day because she wasn't home yet. So I don't envision a scenario where someone knocks at her door under false pretenses and tries to lure her out. I think it's a pretty low percentage play at night, especially considering the person can't show up under the guise of performing work after 10 p.m. If he did something like this in the morning, right before she left for work, it would likely work to perfection. But we have the roadblock of those phones having their batteries removed the night before. That's just too hard to ignore in a situation where the subject in question never returns. In that light, I think Jennifer had been watched for some time, and this person had been waiting. There may have been other nights when the opportunity didn't arise, and he went home empty-handed. But the reason for that is what he really needed is for Jennifer to leave her condo later at night when nobody was around. They couldn't break into her place and certainly couldn't leave the body there or rape and murder her inside. No matter what happened, things had to appear as though she left the development before it did. Because that's where this crime takes place. I believe Jennifer was most likely approached while she was placing items in her car, which explains why she has both cell phones on her at the time. She could have even been surprised in the dark stairwell leading from her building. The perpetrator likely had a gun, knife, or at least something that would insinuate the immediate danger of death. My money is on a gun, as it's the easiest way to control somebody in the absence of physical contact. From there, Jennifer was quietly led to another building in the development, whether it was the home where the worker was staying, or another unfinished unit that was scheduled to be finished shortly thereafter. I'd bet on the unfinished unit. At that point, she was sexually assaulted, probably for an extensive period of time, perhaps several hours, and in a situation possibly involving at least one other man, if not more. At the culmination of this event, in the early morning hours when it was still dark, I believe Jennifer was led back to her condo, instructed to get ready for work as usual, and under the false pretense that she would actually be allowed to go there once she dropped this man off in a new location a few hours away, at which point she left the condo again with the perpetrator. This likely would have been just before the construction crew arrived, sometime around dawn, yet not when it was so dark it would seem unrealistic for Jennifer to be leaving for work. Jennifer then drove the car to this distant location at gunpoint, all the way being told she'd just be dropping the perpetrator off somewhere so he can disappear. She doesn't need to believe it. She only has to hope it's true, because she's being held at gunpoint, and fighting back is likely going to bring imminent death. Obviously, when they get to this place, Jennifer is murdered. Of course, we don't know how, but we can assume wherever they went is where the body ended up. Johnny's assertion of Jennifer being eaten by gators doesn't seem so far-fetched. Yet, however the body was disposed of, it was done so in a manner intended for it to disappear, as there has been no trace of Jennifer since 2006. Anyhow, after disposing of the body, the killer returns to the car, drives back to the Huntington on the Green Apartments, abandons the vehicle, and walks 1.2 miles back to the Mosaic at the Millennia, thereby putting himself in the only place Jennifer and her car are not at the time. At work, with an alibi, in a situation where it seems the missing person left on her own that morning. If he lives and works at the location, the key to being perceived as innocent is making the crime appear as though it happened elsewhere. Nobody else has motivation to make the situation appear as though Jennifer went to work in the morning. Given the incident with the cell phones the night before, I'm unwilling to believe Jennifer left to go to her job the next morning. It simply does not work. One of those workers could walk around at night without suspicion if he lived there. He could learn Jennifer's routine, even just by accident. She was not lured out of her home by somebody texting or calling her. If you were located at the premises, you wouldn't need a vehicle to get there and wouldn't look like a visitor walking around. You would just need to surprise Jennifer when she came outside. And I believe that's what happened. Again, no forced entry, no sign of a struggle. Somebody waited for an opportunity and finally got it. Jennifer left her apartment late at night when nobody was in the parking lot or looking out their windows for what seemed a harmless quick trip to her car and didn't realize that's exactly what a sexual predator had been hoping for all along. When you locate the tragedy, you've likely arrived at the truth. She walked into a trap. I don't think this crime speaks to a perpetrator acting in the name of jealousy, or even with regard for passion, at least beyond the pursuit of sexual satisfaction he otherwise couldn't have. It's clinical, cold, and designed, but not fueled by rage. Emotion seems to have little place in the sequence of events. I don't feel it at all. There's no physical altercation to be found, no revealing texts or phone calls. What it suggests is that Jennifer not only didn't know her killer, at least beyond recognizing his face from working at the site, but that he acted as casually in approaching her as he did when abandoning the car at noon on January 24th. An event involving a person she knows would most likely be precipitated by an argument or something of that nature. But what we don't see at any point in the progression of events is evidence that the perpetrator is angry or has lost control. He follows through on his plan from start to finish, walking away free in the end. This dude remains cool as a cucumber and never gets caught, despite being captured on security footage at an apartment complex near Jennifer's home, and obviously being seen by other people along the way. He doesn't know the victim, and he isn't connected to any of the other suspects in this case. He's a ghost. This was a crime of opportunity. The killer is long gone, likely in another country. I certainly can't say for sure, but I believe the hesitation on the part of police to investigate further was based in this reality. By the time they realized the truth, this guy had already become a needle in an international haystack far too big for their resources to accommodate. Foreign undocumented workers come and go in this country, especially from Mexico and regions farther south in Central America. Tracking them can be incredibly difficult, often fruitless, and an endeavor that requires coordination with other law enforcement agencies to make any sort of progress. That's not even considering the uphill task of actually making an arrest that results in extraditing the suspect back to Florida. It's a fairly complex problem. So, again, I have to speculate like everybody else, but I believe the suspect in question would be someone who lived and worked at the condo development and did not intend to be there much longer. His plan to escape detection seems to be more of a diversion than a long-term solution. Now, I arrived at this conclusion by way of a very simple method. Keep speculating about what might have happened until the logic crumbles. When it does, go in a different direction. In terms of the coworkers, the sex trafficking, the ex-boyfriend, and so on, the logic crumbles. There are dead ends, especially the connection to the man driving Jennifer's car. However, at no point whatsoever in my exploration of a construction worker committing the crime did I feel the need to force the logic in an effort to connect the dots. In fact, this possibility offered an abundance of options for the manner in which the perpetrator could commit the crime under the given circumstances, and also in the absence of needing to be tied to the driver of the car, because he and that person are one and the same. But for some reason, so many people are resistant to this idea, especially the police. At first, they ascertained Jennifer was abducted on the way to her car, and then it became popular to say she might have been abducted on the way to work. Both of these possibilities introduce an ambush in broad daylight where the suspect almost certainly would have been caught in the act. But he wasn't. The cell phone neglecting to ping the night before tells us all we need to know. The incident started at that time when she was abducted for the purpose of sexual assault, and then continued into the next morning at Jennifer's apartment, finally culminating in her murder and disposal of the car elsewhere that morning. Because if the killer doesn't have to return to the construction site himself, and do so within a certain time frame, then there's absolutely no reason for him to take the huge risk of driving Jennifer's car anywhere near her home. He could leave it in a more remote location where he'd have far less chance of being seen by security cameras or eyewitnesses. But he doesn't do that, because he doesn't have a choice. He needs to get back to work, or it's going to become obvious to a lot of people that he's gone at the same time police roll in asking about Jennifer Kessie. Unfortunately, and with all due respect, I have to assume that the police originally assigned to this case just bagged it, and any good investigative work that has followed has amounted to a perpetual game of too little, too late. Jennifer's killer is gone. That's not criticism. It's an observation based upon consideration of available resources. Nobody employed at the construction site who had first-hand knowledge of the crime was going to talk to police, especially illegal aliens. And there's no indication the cops felt satisfied that the perpetrator wasn't a worker at the Mosaic at Millennia. It just seems they didn't make any progress on that path. Nor did they make progress anywhere else. Not with coworkers, the ex-boyfriend, or on any other front. So the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey remains a mystery. But again, to summarize, what I believe most likely happened is that Jennifer was accosted outside her condo while taking items to her car, including the phone she had to remember to bring to work to ship the next day. If by chance she was making an effort to ship these things at night, the same goes. She was approached while going to the car. Even still, she could have been taking trash to a dumpster. From there, I believe Jennifer was taken to an unfinished unit in the development, where she was sexually assaulted by the perpetrator, and perhaps others, for the better part of several hours before being led back to her condo while it was still dark in the early morning hours. She was told to shower and get ready for work as usual. At that point, she's led out the door to her car and forced to drive to an unknown location, where she's been told she's dropping off the perpetrator to make his escape, but he actually murders her and discards the body. This is when he drives the car to the Huntington on the Green and walks 1.2 miles back to the Mosaic at the Millennia. So, I do see an abduction scenario in the morning after Jennifer gets ready for work, but not one that starts then. It starts with the cell phones the night before. I believe it's very important to include both the cell phones and Jennifer's apparent departure for work in the morning as part of the same school of thought, rather than opposing views that put you on one side of the fence or the other. The narrative here suggests that the phone batteries being removed ignites the incident at 10:40 p.m. on January 23rd, and then Jennifer's departure in her car after showering and getting dressed for work the next morning also happens. And why does the killer decide to do it like that? If he kills her at the condo development, he then has to risk being seen putting her body in the car. It's a bad look. That's not even considering that dogs will pick up the smell of cadaver if she's murdered and left to sit for any period of time. It could also be messy. So, faced with the choice of leaving the condo development with her body, or Jennifer on her own 2 feet, and driving her own car, thereby drawing less suspicion, the higher percentage play is to take her alive. It also gives you a hostage as insurance in case you get pulled over by the cops or something similar happens. In the end, all of the persons of interest in this case have told their story and have not been arrested or existed under constant scrutiny by the police as suspects. Except the unknown man who had possession of Jennifer's car that fateful day. He remains an enigma. So does her disappearance. That's the connection. We don't know where Jennifer ended up. And we wonder the same about that man. If we could find either of them, we'd have the truth within our grasp. But I fear it's gone, never to return. So, in reviewing this case, there were some things that truly caught my attention, and others I've excluded that some people believe have a lot of value in discussing. Opinions vary greatly on this case, and it's no wonder why that is. But if there's anything I learned in research that's resonated with me, something that will last beyond the time of my exploration and into my thoughts for years to come, it's that final conversation Jennifer had with her boyfriend Rob, the last time they ever spoke, and actually the last time anyone Jennifer knew had contact with her. For all intents and purposes, that was her final connection to anybody who cared about her life and well-being. So, I noticed while reading that Jennifer apparently once told Rob that she loved him, and the sentiment wasn't returned, something that bothered Jennifer quite a bit. She'd been hoping their trip together and moving in with each other could help, but felt like she might need to break things off in the event nothing changed. And it made me wonder about that final conversation on the phone the night of January 24th, 2006, about those hopes Jennifer had that her boyfriend would finally say he loved her. The trip the weekend before had taken place by then, and by all accounts, it went really well. So I wonder if it changed anything. I mean, did he say it? That was the last conversation she ever had with anybody but her killer. Did Jennifer Kesey leave this earth wondering if she was loved? Or when she hung up that phone, did she finally know it was true? Did she get to hear those words before meeting a horrible fate? I keep hoping in my heart that she did, even if that's not for me to know. Yet the point is that the two of them never saw each other again. It was over. Just like that. Without warning. That's how the end comes for all of us. And so maybe my question goes unanswered. But Jennifer, who had hoped to hear I love you, more likely only heard the most ironic word ever spoken to her. Goodbye. And then she was gone for eternity. So I ask myself, if we suffer an existence where nobody ever tells us it's the end, and at any moment something can happen that will cause us to never see each other again for the rest of time, do I really want to have a life that always says goodbye? Or do I want to be the person who says I love you before hanging up that phone? After considering Jennifer's final call, even just for a moment, the answer is clear.